Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is August 26th, 2002. Today's session is Politics and the Middle East Peace, presented by Anne Hafton, session number HAA 2002-02. Let's listen in.
This session is called The Middle East Peace Process, The Failure of Oslo, and the Folly of the Generous Offer. A lot of nice language in there.
You should say Mrs. Pastor again here.
Yeah, Mrs.
For newlyweds.
Congratulations. Thank you. I'll say from my own background, I've been an amateur student of the Middle East for a long, long time, with lots of trips there and leading tour groups there and making friends there. And only since May have I been able to apply this, begin to apply this in a professional way. And my training is in journalism, and I've worked most of my career for the Evangelical Lutheran Church or its predecessors. And I had this side interest in Middle East concerns, and I just always stayed interested in it and kept moving my file folders full of increasingly out-of-date materials from one location to another as I went through life. In May, I started working for the Division for Global Mission, ELCA, and my title is Coordinator for Middle East Networking. This came about because since the most recent intifada and the Israeli response, our congregations and members of our congregations have been asking the ELCA, where do I get this information? How do I know who to write to? Who do I call? What website do I go to? And we have a lot of rich resources, as well as human networks on the ground in communities around the U.S. We also have a strong missionary presence and a strong Lutheran church presence in the region. So we have lots to offer, but there was no kind of one place where people could get some of that information and some help around organizing. So that's my job now, 15 hours a week, world peace, and on a contract. So I'm working on it, and I hope to come to some of your communities or help you link up with the people in your communities that might want to work consciously on the peace effort for the Middle East. Most of you have probably heard something in the news in the last year and a half about the situation in Israel and Palestine. And I want to be clear that if you hear from me what sounds to you like too much of one side or the other, that may be. And I won't really apologize for it. I'll just say that it could happen. I'll ask you to remember two things. One is what I quoted the other night, what Viola Rahab, the Palestinian woman, said to the ELCA assembly last year. Get on the side of the people who are working for peace. And they are Israelis and Palestinians, Christians, Jews, and Muslims. And don't concern yourself so much with which nation, state, or political group you're on. And the other thing is that there are more voices from one side in our media and in our public policy. And that is simply a fact, that what as many times as you hear about the violence in some setting in Israel, there is violence in Palestine that you have not heard about. And so if you hear from me stories or references that sound like they're way over on the Palestinian side, that may be because I'm pretty sure you're getting the other side in the public media. But go ahead and just make that judgment in your own minds and bear in mind those two things about which side you're on. The situation in the West Bank and Gaza now is just about intolerable. And it comes as a result now of almost 2 years of frustration and violence on all sides. And the situation for folks living in the land we call Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza, presently is one of web of checkpoints that prohibit their free transit from one place to another. And even if they could move, get out onto the road, which they can't do because mostly they're under curfew. And this means a few things. Viola, who is an educator and a Lutheran woman in Bethlehem, was, I relate to this story because I was married 6 weeks ago. She is a fine leader in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan. She met a wonderful Palestinian man who is a musician and a teacher of music in Germany, and they plan to marry this past spring. And they couldn't get their wedding organized very well because of the curfew problems and the checkpoints that made it impossible for their family to gather. And there's no, the long involved story, but the bottom line is that in the end, none of Viola's family were able to be with her, especially her mother, because they were married in Jordan. Just as a way to, that was the one place they could both get to and have their wedding and then move to Germany where they're going to live together. They could not get their families together because of the curfews and the checkpoints to have a wedding. And I remember, think of the wedding at Cana, you know, and my own wedding, and my heart just sort of breaks. My friend Bassam Banura, who's a pastor in Beit Sahur, last spring, a year ago, his young son Daoud, who is Arabic for David, Daoud was set to graduate from high school. He went to an academy high school in Jerusalem. Beit Sahur is about, I don't know, 25 minutes maybe at most from Jerusalem in the school. The whole family got in the car to go to his high school graduation. There was we had to go through the checkpoint at Bethlehem, on the Bethlehem Road, and they were stopped. They had a pass, they had all their papers in order, but for no good reason, they were prohibited from entering Jerusalem that particular day, that particular time. None of them was a terrorist, but the terrible sorrow of that is not just that Daoud missed his high school graduation. That's pretty bad. You only get one. But what that does to his young soul and his way of thinking when he sees himself and his family and his father pushed up against the side of the car, searched, stopped, not allowed to proceed, turned back. This does damage to a young person's soul. And that kind of damage happens every single day, every hour, at the innumerable checkpoints all around the West Bank and Gaza, and in much more violent and difficult situations than my friends encountered. Theirs was a heartbreak, but no one got hurt, no one got shot. I heard a story just last week from ELCA missionaries in Jerusalem about a family, and this could happen to anybody. It happened to have someone that they knew of who's, you know, of Arabic families, like some of ours, live in a multi-generational household. Their old auntie died, and normally they would have taken her to the funeral home and carried out the funeral with a prompt burial that's customary in that culture. But because of the curfew, none of them could leave their homes. The curfew means you cannot leave your home. You can't go shopping. You can't take your children to school. You can't go out at all. And if you go out, you are at risk of being shot. This is what curfew means. It's not like be home by 11. So here's the auntie on the dining room table for a number of days until they are able to get an opening, a little window in the curfew when they can take care of life's business and death's business. And in any culture, that is not the way families honor their aged parents and aunties, or they're dead. These are maybe two graphic examples, but they are examples of the way life is under the most extreme kind of occupation that exists now. So what we have is two cultures, the Palestinian and the Israeli, both living under shadow of suffering and fear. And the Israelis live in a constant state of suffering and fear as well. It's different, but it certainly is fear. They're afraid to go on a bus. They're afraid to sit in a cafe. They're afraid to go to a public place. And the important thing to know is that in both of these cultures and on both sides of this line, most of the people are not to blame. There are extremists in politics and extremists on the street. Among the Palestinian extreme parties and among the settlers, among the Israeli politicians and among the Palestinian leadership. But here we have a failure of leadership on all sides, such that people are suffering this terrible fear and pain on both sides. I want to give you some maps, if you didn't get one when you first came in, and show you a little bit about what occupation looks like. You might want to come where there's light. Can you guys sort of share and pass these around so that you can see? Here you go. When we start to talk about the peace process, the first item on the table is security for Israel and its right to exist, and a Palestinian state. There's a gap in what we mean when we say a Palestinian state. This past year kind of learned the important language that it takes to talk about a Palestinian state. It has to be described as a viable state with contiguous borders. The reason is the map in front of you, which shows the way the most recent peace plan has presented a projected Palestinian state. These purple chunks that are not contiguous and are divided by Israeli highways and do not include the borders with either Jordan or Egypt. This comes out of a history of the Oslo agreements that you might remember in 1988, where, remember the famous, I was thrilled when President Clinton stood there with Arafat and President Rabin, and oh man, I thought, almost there, this is going to happen. I hadn't actually read the agreement, but you know, I saw the TV handshake, and I was so thrilled and so hopeful. And even before that, I'm sorry, I said that was 88, but it was 93. As early as 1988, this barrier that had been in place for a long time, where the Israelis said, "Well, the Palestinians won't accept our right to exist." As early as 1988, Yasser Arafat said at the UN that they would accept the UN resolutions that gave Israel its own right to exist within the borders before the 1967 war, and also accommodated a Palestinian state in what was left on the other side. So often you hear this, well, they wouldn't let us have our right to exist. But Arafat said something about that quite a while ago. Then in 1993, we had this great Oslo agreement that looked so hopeful and so promising, but it went terribly wrong. And there are some important reasons that we don't hear much about. And I'll try to run through them so you can get a picture of how a promising peace negotiation has deteriorated into what we have now. First, the agreement called upon Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority to provide police and security in the West Bank and Gaza. And this was an insurmountable task, really. This was asking really unformed police force and security operation to do what Israel had not been able to do, which was cease any violence and disruption and quell the outbursts from the most extreme factions of the Palestinians. It fell to Arafat to take care of that, to do something the Israelis had not been able to do, and I think we know that it didn't succeed. Another important failure was Israel's refusal to withdraw from the West Bank and Gaza, the territories pre-1967. That was part of the Oslo Agreement. They were supposed to withdraw. But actually, they never did. And so when you get up to the beginning of this most recent uprising of a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, it's born out of this frustration with the failure of Israel to honor its commitments that it made in the Oslo Agreement. They also didn't deal with most of the tough issues. This was, who knows, why they decided to maybe rush into an agreement and put these tough things aside and come back and deal with them later. They were the borders, the problem of the settlements that I'll return to, the problem of Palestinian refugees, the hundreds of thousands of whom live all over the Middle East, and the acute problem of Jerusalem, which was part of what triggered the problem of the most recent intifada. The settlements are the major obstacle, and they show up here on the map. The duplicity. I have Israeli friends, and I have spent a lot of time in Israel. But the duplicity of the policy does not begin just recently. The policy of expanding settlements to create a block of Israeli control begins way back in the Begin era, and when Sharon, who is now the prime minister, was the housing administrator, and he put this in place very deliberately. But even since Oslo, the population of the settlements has doubled, and so you can see that. There were 100,000 people living in the West Bank settlements, Jews, Israelis. And so here the Palestinians are trying to live out this Oslo Agreement, and they have all kinds of problems in their own community, corruption, and there are definitely problems in the Palestinian culture. But at the same time, the Israelis, who are supposed to be withdrawing from the West Bank, instead they are building, and they're building faster and faster, such that since 1993, the settlements in the West Bank have doubled. And there are more than 200,000 settlers now living in the West Bank, and that doesn't include East Jerusalem, which is home to another almost 200,000 Israelis. And East Jerusalem is technically occupied West Bank and the future home of the Palestinian capital. So this was a problem with the process itself, but it's also a terrible festering source of antagonism in the Palestinian community. Land continued to be confiscated at a rapid pace, and homes demolished, and there's a very involved administrative system. Israel refers to its administration of the West Bank. They don't use the word occupation. They call it administration. And they always refer to it as a civil administration, as if it's, you know, just water and power. But it's run by the military, and the head of the civil administration is an Israeli colonel. So it's all a little how you use language. You're a Palestinian, and you want to add on to your house, add a bedroom or a bathroom, or build a new home on land your family owns, you have to apply for a building permit. And most of the time, you can't get one. It just will not be issued to you. There might be a sequence of kind of stalling maneuvers, but lots of times they don't even bother with that ruse. It's just not issued to you. That's to add a bedroom. At the same time, these settlements around Jerusalem were exploding as more and more land was confiscated, and these beautiful townhouses are built in a giant flanking maneuver all around Jerusalem to create what in Israeli policy is called Greater Jerusalem or Municipal Jerusalem, as they've moved toward taking Jerusalem from a city and a city that they're supposed to be on the west side of, and created a metroplex, a giant municipality, like with ringing highways and highways through that make it impossible to go back and reclaim the old East Jerusalem. It's what's called facts on the ground. So this was already the situation when Prime Minister Barak met with Yasser Arafat in the waning days of the Clinton administration. And this probably looked to you like it did to me, kind of a desperate maneuver to solve something before Bill Clinton left office. But it was definitely a rush job. For one thing, this gets us to this idea of Barak's generous offer. This is what you always hear on the media. Israel made the most generous offer it had ever been made to Palestine, and they turned it down. The historic missed opportunity. I can make sure I get this right now. But this was in 2000. And this was no bargain for the Palestinians. They were being asked to give up more land than they had already agreed to give up. They had already agreed to, in Camp David, you have to figure, when Palestinians look at all of Israel and Palestine together, they think of that as their old country. That used to be their country. So when they think about just the West Bank and Gaza, that's not the whole thing to them. To them, that's just 22% of what they used to have. So by accepting just the West Bank and Gaza instead of trying to claim more, they already feel like they've come a long way. But at the Camp David meeting, they were asked to give up another 10% that would be controlled by Israel now, because they had so much, so many highways to protect, so many settlements to protect, and they had a lot of settlements that had grown a lot, and so the Palestinians were asked, Arafat was asked to agree to give up an additional 10% of what he had left. And then he also had to relinquish control of another 10%. They could live there, but Israel would have what they call temporary control, which doesn't really ever go away. And then there are all these roads and checkpoints that have been built since 1993, when Oslo was started and Israel started their big building project. They've built all these thoroughfares, roads that only Israelis can drive on, with gas stations that only Israelis can buy gas at, and that take them to shopping centers where only Israelis can shop. And so that Israelis can move freely from settlement to settlement, in and out of Jerusalem, to shop, to buy gas, to buy food, on roads that Palestinians are not allowed on without passing through the checkpoints that they're not allowed to go through. Does this sound like anything to you that might have happened in South Africa a few years ago? This is apartheid, a warning. And the Palestinians know it. And so as they're asked now to agree to allow all these roads, these new highways, these new controlled roads, and increase checkpoints to be a new constant in their land, they're just starting to boil over. And the frustration was very high. Also, Israel would continue to control the borders with Jordan and Egypt. What that means is that there are islands of Palestinian control, but for example, over along the Jordan River, let me hold this up. Over here, this pale pink area, most of that is called Nature Preserve. And it's administered by the Israeli army. And that's Nature Preserve. And then all this other pink stuff here is all Israeli controlled. So what you end up with is these islands, these little Bantustans, they call them. And, this was impossible to accept. If you look at this, does this look like a viable sovereign state with contiguous borders? It can't be. It can't govern itself that way. It can't protect its borders. It can't feed its people. It can't provide transportation. And so Arafat declined. He turned down this generous offer. And that put us into a situation where where we are now, because Sharon, who succeeded Barak, would never have even gone ahead with this plan. He is this is his design. He dreamed this up and he has carried it out. So maybe that's a point. It just kind of brings us up to the present and in the whole process. That only the most recent development is the proposal from the Saudi prince Abdullah, which I can go into a little bit if you want me to. But maybe I should stop and see if you have questions or things I need to clarify.
Yeah. Could you clarify the definition of an Israeli? Is there a racial derivation or a religious derivation that goes with that? In other words, can a Palestinian person become an Israeli or a member of whatever?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are a lot of Palestinians or Arabs who are Israelis. They're called Israeli Arabs by Israelis. They call themselves Palestinians. They are people who lived, who resided in the State of Israel in 1948 when Israel was established, and at the conclusion of the war that sealed that State of Israel. And they have, they can vote, they have members of parliament, but they are kind of second-class citizens in many ways. They're the last to receive municipal improvements. Many of their villages have been declared unincorporated. So they have a village that's been there for hundreds and hundreds of years, but now it's not on the map anymore. And so no power goes there, water's not served there. I visited one of these unincorporated villages a few years ago up near Nazareth, and you had to climb up a steep thing to get there. And as we went, we passed a donkey that was carrying a big tub of, a big vat thing of water. We call it like a barrel, yeah. And because they had no water service up there. And there's a hillside village. And right across the valley, there's a steep valley, and then on the other side of the valley there was an Israeli settlement, not a settlement, because it was an Israeli town in Israel. And they had the sprinklers going and for the soccer court. And they had all the water they needed over there on the other side. It's just one of those. Israeli is an Israeli by being a Jew for purposes of immigration. Their law is that any Jew from anywhere in the world can immigrate and be an Israeli citizen automatically. Mm-hmm. Those Arabs who would want to become Israeli citizens, no. Christians and Muslims, no. But that goes to the essence of the nature of the Zionist state, which is to provide a secure home for the Jews.
Mm-hmm. Sojourner had an article about the settlements, and they said that they reported that people from, say, New York, who were Jewish, mm-hmm. would come, and they'd been there for about 10 days, and they'd be kicking people out who were Palestinian and the family had been there for hundreds of years. Does that kind of thing really happen?
Yeah. Well, in the West Bank, I mean, it takes a little while. They don't really kick anyone out. They confiscate land or buy it, and they start a new settlement on land that was once occupied by, or once, I don't want to use occupied, once resident to, or agricultural land for folks who had been there for hundreds of years, yeah. But the most recent, research is showing that really the people who are fanatical about living in the settlements are a small minority. Of the 250,000 settlers, not including Jerusalem, that live in the West Bank, 80% are not religious diehards, and they would leave if they could buy an equivalent home inside Israel. The reason for many of them to live in the settlements is because they got a good government subsidy to move there. Now, let me try to say something about the map, because I want to emphasize that this is not an accident, it's a design. Back as far as some of you are old enough to remember Moshe Dayan, who said, we have to have people there. We have to have people living there. Because if we don't, then our soldiers are an invading army. They have to always think of themselves and be seen by the world as defending the Israelis who are living here. And that has stayed with this policy all along. The people flanking Jerusalem, the people living in the outlying settlements, are there as a matter of policy, government policy. That's why the good subsidies and the 2-to-1 security protection that they offer.
So, what you're saying is that if you put in settlers in areas, if they go in, then all of a sudden you have to provide security.
Yeah.
And then the issue is, it's always security. And it just so happens that you've carved out most of the West Bank, and then you're simply, of course, providing nothing but security for these people.
Yeah, well said.
But then by the time you're all done, you look at the map, and by simply doing nothing but providing security, all the Palestinians are pushed into certain areas.
Or they've emigrated.
Or they've just left.
Moved, yeah. Now, that's a good lead-in to something that I wanted to say about the reasoning behind this policy. Israel has a problem, and that is they don't really want to. And when I say they, I don't mean everyday Israelis. I mean policymakers and leaders in Israel. And there's been a right-wing government in place for quite a while now in Israel. They don't want a Palestinian state. That's really not what they want. They would like that to not happen because they don't want to have relations with the Palestinian state or defend against a state that is armed and receiving aid and all the things that a sovereign state has. But on the other hand, they don't want a high Palestinian demographic in Israel. So they need to keep this Palestinian population contained and outside the 67 borders. And otherwise, you could say, well, why don't they just take the whole thing and just make it Israel? That'd be a simple solution for them. They don't want all those Palestinians in their population. They want their demographic to stay Jewish majority. That is crucial to Israel's way of thinking about itself as a Jewish state. And plus, it's just a matter of the votes and the birth rate. They could not tolerate the number of Palestinians that live in the West Bank coming in and being part of the Israeli population. So instead, they colonized the West Bank with their own population and concentrated the Palestinian population into these purple areas. And then they're going to offer them statehood in these little islands. So it's a very interesting solution to a thorny problem. But they have, I mean, if you look at it, and this is the tragedy, is that they have succeeded. They've succeeded pretty well. They've solved their problem. They don't have the Palestinian state, because this is not a state. And they don't have the Palestinians living in Israel either. But what they also don't have is peace or security or a happy population. Everyone is scared to death, angry, and the Palestinians are living in fear and suffering and anger and violence. So there's where it stands right now. Before I go on, because I don't want to run out of time before I do this, I want to tell you a little bit about some resources that are in the bookstore and that I brought. And then I can come back to some questions. These items are all in the bookstore, and I'll tell you a little bit about them. This book, I'm a Palestinian Christian, is written by a Lutheran pastor. His name is Mitri Raheb. He's Viola's brother. He's the pastor at Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem. Now, I got to tell you a good story about Mitri. I just heard the other day from our missionaries in Jerusalem. Another friend who visited there. And he went to Bethlehem to visit Mitri. And in addition to the Christmas Lutheran Church, they're very ambitious and entrepreneurial there in Bethlehem. They've established this international center where they want to have a place for people to explore alternative tourism and create a media center. And they have a school there, and it's very ambitious. But of course, with the curfews, everything has been closed down in the building. How can it go on? And everything is shut down. And plus, with all the destruction of the incursions, they have a lot of way to come back before they can get to where they were with this building project 2 years ago. So Martin, my friend, went to visit Mitri, and he said, well, I'm sure, you know, you haven't been able to make any progress. And Mitri said, well, come and see. So I went into this, because Martin's on this media advisory committee for the media center. And he was all, they'd been so excited about having computers and internet connections and a satellite and a way to get the Palestinian story out to the world, their own TV station and everything. And of course, much of it was damaged in the incursion. But they went in, Pastor Mitri opened the door, and they went in, and here were people working all over the place, pounding and, you know, scraping, and work was going on like mad inside that place. And all the rest of Bethlehem looks really shabby and destroyed. And Martin just said, wow, how have you kept this going and with the situation? And Mitri said, look, we're giving 60 people jobs here. Most people in the West Bank cannot work. There's 90% unemployment. I mean, I started to cry when I heard that. They had 60 people working at jobs at the Bethlehem International Center. That's Pastor Mitri Raheb, and his book is in the bookstore. He says, I'm a Palestinian Christian. That's important because Christians are a small minority in the Palestinian community. And he could have said, I'm a Lutheran, but it's real important for Lutherans, Anglicans, Catholics, and Coptics and so forth to identify strongly as Christians and be unified in that. I talked a little bit about the Israeli Arabs. This book, The Other Side of Welcome, is the story of one of those Israeli Arabs who's become quite well known, his father, Elias Shakur. I haven't read this book, but I saw it in the bookstore, and I thought, I'm going to get that. I want to read it because I met him, and he is a very strong minister to the Israeli Arab Christian population up near Nazareth. This big picture book is really beautiful. I looked at it for the first time this afternoon. This is called Bethlehem 2000. I'm pretty sure that this was prepared for the 2000 millennium Bethlehem celebration that was not as successful as it should have been because of the Intifada. But this has a lot of beautiful pictures and background on Bethlehem and the whole area and the Christians that live there. This is written by Mitri Raheb and Fred Strickert, who was here on teaching staff, I think, 2 weeks ago. I love this. It's beautiful. And it's not just a Holy Land tour book. It really tells about the institutions and the people and all the different kinds of Christians. Very interesting. These two books are ones that I recommended, and I'll tell you a little bit about them. This is called A Little Too Close to God. It's by David Horovitz. I just thought it was important to put in a book by an Israeli. And I read this book this winter. I came away liking him a lot, but still being really mad at him. I think he makes a lot of excuses for policy in Israel, but he's a leftist. He claims to be a progressive. He lives in Israel with his family in Jerusalem, and he tells about what that's like. And that's not a bad thing to find out. His sister lives in a settlement in the West Bank, and he fights with her all the time about that. But when push comes to shove and the settlements look like they might be at risk or under attack, he still says it's okay that they should have to protect those settlements. So he's not as liberal as all that. He's not as progressive as I'd like him to be. But he's a thoughtful guy, and he tells his story about being in the left in Israel. And this new book, which is a biggie, this is called The Body and the Blood. It's by Charles Sennett, who writes for the Boston Globe. This is a really big, thorough book, but it's the first one, I think, that really looks into the question of the Christians of the Middle East. He doesn't limit himself to Palestine. He talks about Lebanon and Egypt, thank you. But he's looking at the question of why are there fewer and fewer and fewer Christians in the Middle East. And this is a real, real interesting book. And lastly, this little newsletter. Barb, you told me this was in the bookstore, but I couldn't find it, so I'm not sure it's there or not, but maybe it is.
Well, maybe Jonathan took it. No, but it was supposed to be in a box on the teaching staff recommendation shelf.
Well, I'll look for it and try to make it more prominent. If not, I'll give you the address where to write for this. The link is the newsletter of a group called Americans for Middle East Understanding. This is a group that we are involved with. I am through Church World Service, the National Council of Churches, Church World Service. What they did about a year ago, and I was an advisor to this group, or a participant, is they created for journalists a lexicon of terms. And the idea was to try to put this in the hands of folks who would give it to journalists. And hope that some of the reporting could begin to take on a little bit more, let's say, continuity or integrity. And just to help journalists who try to cover the Middle East and don't know how to talk about that hill where the mosques are, okay? We could call it the Haram al-Sharif, as the Palestinians do, and as I do. But a lot of journalists call it the Temple Mount, which is what the Israelis call it. And so there's a lot of definitions in here that really this was designed to help journalists, but I think it's a really valuable tool for anybody who wants to be working with these issues, especially in your congregation, and you want just to get the vocabulary right. So if this is not in the bookstore, I'll put up here maybe at the end the address of where to get this. Now, the maps I handed out are mine. They're not handouts. I want to use them again the rest of this week, but I do have a lot of handouts, or not a lot, but a couple that I think will be helpful to you. And I'll just ask you to pick them up afterwards if they're something that you would like. And come to me and ask me if you didn't get one. One is a pretty decent map of Palestine and the West Bank, but it's little. It's not as big as those ones you had. So you can have these for your own. And you always need a good bibliography. And this is an action alert that was released just recently by the ELCA's Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs. So if you're interested in writing a letter, this is one you can a way you can get involved.
Could I just take those? I haven't been a bit for 3 days, so I'm going to read.
Yeah. Here's a full kit for you. Sleep well.
Thank you.
And lastly, this flyer called For a Just Peace Between Israel and Palestine which is put out by the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of these, so help yourself to these. This is a great Israeli organization that is working hard to stop the demolition of homes and to build new ones. This blue sheet is how to get in touch with me, either by email or web page, and join our listserv that will hope to feed information to congregations about what's happening with our missionaries and with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jerusalem and with our advocacy efforts in Washington. Here I put three websites that will be helpful to you if you're looking for this kind of information and you can't catch me for some reason or you want to do it when you get home. And if you want these posters that say, end the illegal occupation of Palestine, support a just peace in the Middle East, these are distributed by the World Council of Churches. I have a few of them, and if you want one, I'll take a free will offering. I want to say one more thing before I ask for your questions. I was so struck by this phrase in the Vespers tonight, because I think this is the promise. You know, it's so, whenever I start to get into this policy world, I get so discouraged. I don't see a way out, honestly. And I have to look to some other place to get some hope. But this phrase, I loved it. Justice like a mountain, our shadowed valley finds. Now, there are so many shadowed valleys in this place that I love so much, that it's full of people who want peace and want just a normal life. They want to be able to get their kids to school. They want their kids to be able to take their term tests like they couldn't at the end of this year. And so I found a promise in this, justice like a mountain, because this is a call for justice, really. Peace with justice. And there are lots of, you know, political initiatives and processes, and some of them haven't worked, and maybe one will. But I have to have faith in that. Justice like a mountain, our shadowed valley fills. I'm open to your questions or discussion if you want to go on a little longer.
Uh-huh. What I saw when visiting there was not only what you said about the purposeful establishment of the settlements on the West Bank in such a manner as to divide the geographic area and provide areas of strategic importance, but the fact that these settlements were put up in locations where there was no possibility of meaningful agriculture, where there was no pre-existing industry, or other means of support for the people who were settling there. But these were just like California subdivisions, established out in the middle of the desert, with the one exception, and that was that many of these subdivisions, by the time they were completed, were completely unoccupied and remained completely unoccupied for a substantial period of time while the Israeli government was frantically encouraging people to immigrate into Israel in order to occupy these settlements.
When were you there?
4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I remember that time. Well, and another feature to the settlements, particularly those that ring around Jerusalem, Har Homah is one we've heard a lot about, and others in the there are settlements, and then there are what they call a settlement block. And one way they've gotten around the not ceasing to build settlements is that they refer to them to what they're doing as not building new settlements, but just, they use this expression, thickening, just kind of building out the existing settlements in their natural growth pattern is what they call it, so that they link up with others and they become what they now call settlement blocks, which are much bigger. The interesting architectural feature about those, particularly that ring around all the way around Jerusalem, and the meanness of this is that inside that ring is East Jerusalem, the Palestinian capital, they hope. And at this point, they cannot get there. There's almost no transit through those settlements anymore. And it wasn't even that way when I was there, about the same time you were. You could still find a road to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Almost today you cannot find a road that Palestinians are allowed to drive on that goes to East Jerusalem. What I was going to say, architecturally, you'll see that they all face outward, and they slope down like this to the east, and they are built. And an Israeli told me this: they are built deliberately as fortifications. They are intended to be the flanking guard of Jerusalem. They're built to be defended and to be like a fortress. None of them face Jerusalem. They all face the Jordan. Yeah, it's insidious. And since 1993, since Oslo, in this area, the government has built 29 new highways, including this new north-south transit that is creating the seam that runs down the eastern side of the country. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm going to talk kind of fast, too. Yes?
Any insights at all into influencing the present administration? I think they're influenced by AIPAC, and they're worried about their jobs. But Israel couldn't do what it's doing without our support of $3 plus billion dollars a year and the support of the religious right.
Yeah.
Are there any efforts to...
Yeah, we're doing what we can. I really have to put in a pitch for the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs. And if you're not Lutheran, most of the mainline denominations that would maybe be here at Holden are part of Churches for Middle East Peace, CMAP. Churches for Middle East Peace is our ecumenical partner for advocacy in Washington, working closely with the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs. And I also want to say, I didn't earlier because I referenced ELCA Ministries, but if the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has a presence in the West Bank through the Wheatridge Foundation. So if you're a Missouri Synod and this doesn't help you, go to the Wheatridge webpage. They support Mitri Rahab and the Bethlehem Center. I think the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs does a lot of work with other churches to try to influence policy. It's a very rough go right now. There's a letter, I guess I didn't bring it down here. There's a letter circulating now from church leaders asking specifically for aid because of the curfews and the closures. There's now measurable malnutrition among people of the West Bank, of course, particularly children. And so even just as I left my house, the logo was issuing this letter from our leaders and others asking President Bush to at least send some aid into this situation. The other thing that I said the other night, the Lutherans, would be Bishop Muni Bionan from the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jerusalem and ELCA Bishop Mark Hansen, together with a couple of other church leaders from Palestine, are trying to meet with President Bush. So far, they've been working on it through channels for about 10 weeks or so. So far, they have not got an appointment. They're being shunted over to State Department people, and they... Bishop Yunan is a great character. He's really a great leader. He's a small man, but he's really feisty, and he just said, we're not going to meet with anybody but Bush. We want to meet with President Bush, and that's it. And he said, when I get an appointment, I'm bringing Mark Hansen with me, and we're going to go in and talk about this. They also have a representative of the Catholic Church in Palestine and the Anglican as well. Their plan is to go in and meet with him and talk about these issues and present the case of the leadership, the Christian leadership in Palestine, saying, use us. We're leaders in our community. Let's work together. They can't get that appointment yet. So when we had the Global Mission events a few weeks ago in the Women's Convention of the ELCA, we just started saying, write to President Bush and ask him to meet with Bishop Yunnan. It's that simple. And I'll write his name on the bulletin board if you want me to. Write to President Bush and ask him to meet with Bishop Yunnan and Mark Hansen. So we try something, you know, we try different things, and hopefully as these advocacy efforts move along, I can keep feeding information to interested congregations and individuals.
Yeah.
You know, I felt really discouraged by something I heard on NPR about, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. There was a special interview with Israelis, and what the gist of it was that the so-called left in Israel has kind of disappeared, that the majority of Israelis now really support what's going on there, unlike the way it was maybe 10 or 15 years
mm-hmm.
ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the last 18 months have just collapsed the Israeli peace bloc, but they're coming back. They're starting to come back because they just were disempowered by the suicide bombers and by the 9/11, and they lost their grip, I think. And I know some of these people, and they just were floundering. But I'm more and more I'm reading that they're bouncing back, and there are lots of Israelis who are activists. There are lots of I don't want to sound too pro-Israel sometimes, so I don't tout them as much as I should maybe, but there are a lot of positive Israeli websites. This group right here is one of the best, the Committee Against Home Demolitions. They go out with squads of people just like Habitat for Humanity, but they go to a setting where they're not allowed to be, and they build a house there where a house was demolished, and knowing full well that within a week it might be demolished again. And they take Israelis and Palestinians to make sure that they work together in teams. And the Palestinians are the hosts and the Israelis are the guest workers. It's a great organization. So if you need some hope, pick this one up. The Big Peace Now movement, I think they kind of lost steam. But I have hope that they're going to come back. We both read several Israeli newspapers as often as we can, and they're a presence, but they're not a political force right now. That's the problem. There are groups like the Women in Black who continue, and you probably saw them a few years ago. I did, Israeli women who go out and stand on the street corner dressed in black and hold up signs that say "End the Occupation." That was going on in 1991 and 1992, and it still goes on. But it's sometimes it's a little bit like Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, you know, where you see them all the time and people, they become invisible. But they are increasing in their numbers now. So it's discouraging. We heard a dreadful interview with an Israeli teenager who said, hey, you know, they lost, we won, they should just shut up and get over it. Well, you know, that's enough to spoil your day right there. But I find being involved gives me hope and courage, so maybe if we pray together and do something, that'll help.
You mentioned the Saudi plan. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I gotta check my notes on that one. Maybe that should be the last thing, because I know you all want to. I have a little write-up about it, so I get it right. Yeah. Well, it's described here as a simple formulation based on the long-standing Land for Peace idea that is also part of the UN Resolution 242. And it says, full peace with Israel, recognition of and normal relations with Israel in return for full withdrawal by Israel from the pre-67 borders. And then a place there for Palestinians to create a state. It's a kind of a simple, you leave, you know, we say it's okay for you to have to be Israel, you say it's okay for us to be Palestine, and you leave. Now, what it doesn't enunciate anything about is the settlements. That's a kind of a weakness in the plan, but there have been some very creative ideas. One guy that I read in this article about, his name is Mark Heller. He's an Israeli, and he suggested that Abdullah put his money where his mouth is, and he provided the subsidies so the Israelis could move back to Israel, and then they would have vacated all these settlements so Palestinians could move in. I heard a similar solution from Canon Naim Atika, an Anglican, who said a year ago, at a conference I was at, the Israelis won't have to worry about the returning refugees question, which is something we haven't even really talked about tonight. All they have to do is just give us the settlements. We'll move our refugees in there. You know, it makes it kind of beautiful sense. Well, thank you for coming. Do you have one more thing?
You've spoken very convincingly about the problems of the Palestinian Christians, but the majority of Palestinians, after all, are not Christians. While we in this country have Muslim speakers who speak for peace, speak for reconciliation,
do they have any over there?
One of many that have appeared, but one in this week's Christian Century, which is a religious justification of suicide bombing.
Oh dear.
Written after interviews with religious leaders in a Muslim university, I believe, in Egypt, I forgot. We have this continuing problem, this continuing presence of suicide bombing. We have the continued presence of radical groups, radical Muslim groups among the Palestinians. Do you see any hopeful signs of change there besides such very small efforts as the American Friends Service Committee bringing Muslim and Jewish people of a peaceful mind together for meetings, or the Fellowship of Reconciliation bringing students from Muslim and Jewish communities to NIAC to work together for a little while?
I think those are some of the best kinds of things, honestly. There are people in the Israeli peace camp and among Palestinian Christians as well who meet regularly with Muslims, with Muslim leaders. In Beit Sakhur, which is the historically Christian town, the Catholic and Greek Orthodox leaders meet regularly with the Muslims of that town. The mainline Muslim leadership are, while they may not be in regular communication or relations with Christians or Jews, are not supportive of the terror or suicide bombings. I mean, they have articulated that over and over, and it's very important to say that the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan, obviously, and all the Christian leaders have said no to violence on both sides. But the fringe groups, it's hard to speculate. It seems that every time there's an initiative for peace, the violent fringe groups use that as they use violence then to spoil that. And they do it so effectively. It's like, can't they figure this out now that that's going to happen? And I think justice is the only solution. I think when there's peace, and there was in the early stages of Oslo after 93, and for a few years there were no terrorism situations. There was no suicide bombings and no bombings at all. It was because everyone had hope, and that you have to jump a big chasm to get from where we're at now to where there's enough hope for peace and enough promise of justice that violence is not seen to be an option. I don't know what else to say about that. Thanks for asking. I thought I was going to get through the night without that question. But thank you, everybody. And please help yourself to these things. I'm not passing them all up for the solid waste issues here. And return my maps. Yes.
Peter and Kathy are still
there? Yes.
They're in Ramola. Oh, they're still in Ramola.
To my knowledge, they're in Ramola.
Do you work with Mubarak
Ahmad? I'm not close.
Yeah,
I have met him.
Yeah.
But I have not worked with him. I edited something that he, a contribution one time, but I have only met.
He was at our fire when a student's mother had come to join us for dinner, and Mubarak Ahmad said, "I want to go to Gandhi's ashram," and she said, "Oh, write down this number." She had been
The problem for Mubarak now is that he's exiled.
I know.
And he can't be...
He was dangerous.
I know. He lives in Washington.
Yeah.
And he can't... I mean, that's the problem. The vacuum of leadership is really hurting Palestinians.
Yeah. But we were missionaries in Egypt. So.
Oh, what's your name?
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
This is great. I mean, we will join our listserv
and get information, and then you can write back to me.
Well, I've got to get a hold of Mark. Yeah. He still has a picture of mine from Egypt that I want back.
So I'm going to go get it. Very, very
Egypt. Yes, I will. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you very much for that presentation.
Pleasure.
How frequently are you able to get over to Israel at the present time?
We were there a year ago, February. But actually, my new job now has me in ESV congregations. I'm working with people on the website and online. So I don't foresee getting there for another year, maybe. Oh, unless we take a group. There's an interfaith group in Dallas-Fort Worth that meets with Muslims and Jews and Christians. And we'd love to get a group together and go... solidarity, whatever we see.
Some pastors went with a mostly Muslim group a few weeks ago, and the whole group was turned back.
Yes.
Along with congressional representatives.
Mm-hmm. That may have been what I read about.
In
the newspapers, I think it was in the Christian Science Monitor.
But that's a little risk. I've right been going to expect that you have the intention of what you do have intention of doing, which is
helping to support Israelis. You're familiar with the Mennonite Christian Peacemakers movement.
Yes, very.
And I don't know how it's possible for this group to continue to get some respect from both sides. It amazes me that they do, because if there's any group that one might suspect of being considered only in favor of the Palestinians, those people would be the ones.
I'll tell you my judgment why, because they lay it on the line. They put their own bodies on the line. They really risk a lot.
Yes.
I'd be scared to be one of those Christian peacemakers myself.
Yes, I've been kidding.
And they put themselves right between a soldier and a Palestinian. They're really courageous.
Yeah.
And they're really committed to nonviolence.
Yes.
So.
Thanks.
Remarkable. Thank you very much.
Did you come across the Sandra Goss?
No.
Okay. She was doing a lot of work in Ramallah.
Sure, name
many it. Years ago when we were.
She didn't get married. Her name is Sandra Oldwine now. I know a Sandra who works in the Middle East. Her name is Sandra.
I don't know. She grew up in India. We were missionaries in India too. So yeah. We were seconded to the Coptic Orthodox Church.
Wow.
When we were there, so I was a consultant for women's projects.
Wow.
So. You can put all those.
Have you read this, The Body and the Blood?
I think you'd find
he's got a
really
good chapter in there. I'd be interested in your comments
on
about
Egypt.
On Egypt?
On Egypt.
Okay.
And Christians in Egypt.
Okay. Get it back to you.
Have you read it? Actually, you can look at it, but I can't let you take it out of here because I have to return all these to the bookstore.
Okay.
But it's in the bookstore.
Oh, okay. I'll probably email. I'm sure my husband will buy it. Well, oh, man, I tell you, it's so hard to hear the rhetoric in the United States. It's just so hard having been there, and it's just like, oh, man. And so why doesn't anybody ever just lay it out the way that you did? This is the way, I mean, I never hear anybody say how fragmented this is and this fortress mentality
because
and stuff.
Because American...
It doesn't fit into 20 seconds, you know?
I don't think that... I mean, I'm a journalist, so I never call the media evil, but they're just... They're not informed.
Yeah.
I was, like, eating at a restaurant the other night with my daughter, and, you know, that was just... speaking about Palestinians in a way the waitress came up and said, did you say the word Palestinian? I said, yeah. She said, well, I'm going to Jordan. I'm going to work on the Jordan Times, and etc. She said, I could tell by the way that you said the word Palestinian that it would be okay for me to talk to you because I can't tell anybody else because, you know, they just, the mood of people is so pro-Israeli, and the word Palestinian sounds so bad. Nobody ever says it in a way that implies.
In a nice way.
In a nice way.
Yeah.
It just made me cry, you know? That,
we're such softies.
<We're laughs>
I know.
But,
well, I just really understand.
But about she feels like she has to, you know, she's half Jordanian.
Mm-hmm.
And she feels like she has to just keep her lip zipped, you know, in Dallas and Fort Worth, Texas, because...
Well, look, I was standing in the post office. Oh, I don't have that. I had these posters in a tube.
Uh-huh.
And it said on the end, I didn't tell you this, it said on the end where my boss had written Palestine posters. And I had this tube all, you know, sealed up, and I was getting ready to take it to, I think I'll just hide it down here. I was going to take them back to my house. Anyway, it said Palestine posters, and then I had it all sealed up, and I was going to mail it here so I wouldn't have to carry that tube on the airplane. And right, I think that, maybe I'm paranoid, but I suspect that that's why this woman, who was just one back from me, remember when I came back from the post office and I told you this woman went on and on and on and on about Israel and how they ought to just give them all the money so they can go and wipe out the Iraqis for us, and how our real ally is Israel, and she was talking really loud.
Oh, yeah, I wonder
why. In the
why.
Post office. This is...
Oh, God.
And, like, she was trying to make some kind of a point.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, she saw my tune. It's a Palestine poster.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah.
That could be why. Did you know Till Bergman?
Yes.
Oh, where is he now?
He's in the Twin Cities.
Yes.
I just saw him at a meeting. Just before the GME.
On his way out, so that.
Do you know the Swanson Market?
Oh,
the Swanson.
Very good.
I'd like to be, but I thought that's
another thing. Mark is a good friend
well,
and a good ally in the future seminary.
Oh, yeah. And how about Mike and
Joelle? Yeah,
I just emailed them the day before yesterday.
I stayed in their home when I was in Egypt.
Yeah.
I had so much fun with their little boys. I suppose they're big now.
Oh, they are. They're in college. Matthew's in his third year. Well, you must have been in Egypt. When were you?
I was in Egypt in 88.
Oh, okay.
And Harold Vogelaar was
there. Oh, yes. We were there, 87 to 90.
Franz, can you help me here?
I'm
just kidding.
Yeah. We were there, 87 to 90.
Yeah, I was there in 88. And I stayed with the Shelves.
Yeah, Matthew and Timothy. Yeah,
I have a lot of pictures of them and their jammies, you know.
Oh, yes. They were the cutest kids.
Maybe I'll leave these maps. Oh, I'll take everything up with them over here. Yeah, they, and Harold Vogelaar was here last week.
He was. I didn't miss.